Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Retired English professor Carol Burr is an author, editor, and artist who illustrated The Birds of Bidwell Park. Roger Lederer has published many books and papers in the field of ornithology and collaborated with his wife, Carol Burr, on their previous book, The Birds of Bidwell Park. Their newest book, Latin for Bird Lovers, covers the secrets behind more than 3,000 scientific names of birds and why those names were selected. Roger Lederer and Carol Burr, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there's a paragraph in your book that especially struck me because I took Latin in high school, and it was not at the time that I appreciated that teacher, but after I graduated, I wrote a letter to this teacher and thanked her for what she had done, what I had learned from her. So when I saw this paragraph in your book, I was reminded that you thank various people who helped with the creation of this book, and then you say, we would like to thank our high school Latin teachers who had a major influence on us in our careers and pleasures. We didn't realize the benefit at the time, but such is the risk and value in educating the young. And I'm sure that would give encouragement to teachers who feel like maybe at the time, did I really get through to those students? And Carol, you say you taught Victorian literature.
Absolutely.
And so it may be only down the road.
You hope so, because these things are hard work at the time, and you're not sure the relevance to your life. And I think it's an argument for not making a determination on relevance until you are at least 60.
Oh, 60.
Yes, I'm pushing it back. I put it back a decade as I pass one. Yes, because I really think young people just don't know, and I think they need everything they can get. So and I do think that this was a very unusual way to come back to something. It was a benefit for vocabulary, and I always appreciated it for that, but not for writing a book about bird lovers here.
So as I read this book, I was thinking that this is a book for bird lovers and a book for word lovers. And I don't know much about birds, but I do love words. So I was imagining as I was reading this that maybe that was the area that you focused on. And then, of course, the expertise on birds, Roger, that's your field.
Yes.
So how did you divide up the kind of the assignments of writing this book?
Well, I did more of the scientific kinds of things, and she did the pronunciations and the meaning of some of the words. You know, we both overlap in that Latin area, but it was ornithology that was my thing. And so I tried to pick out the names that were the most commonly used. I mean, there are 10,000 species of birds. So I tried to pick out some of the more common genera and species that, you know, people would see often. So this only covers 3,000 names, but they're or 10,000. Somebody did write a book who covered 20,000 names, actually, old ones and new ones, but it's 450 pages long, you know, with a font 10, and it just goes on and on and on. You wouldn't want to read that, but it's a great reference.
Well, speaking of reading, I really enjoyed reading this book, and I hope that people won't think, oh, Latin, I don't know anything about Latin, and think that's all it is, because it's so much more than that. And it was so thought-provoking. I found myself stopping and thinking, oh, I wonder about that, and going to the computer and Googling, for example, New Latin. I thought, New Latin? And so, Roger, you're talking about the pronunciations. And how did you arrive at, Carol, since you did the pronunciation,
yes,
how did you determine what pronunciation? Because there may not be general agreement.
Well, that's true. I mean, I definitely started out not understanding that scientific Latin, New Latin, is post-Renaissance, and I had learned classical Latin.
Which we all do if we study Latin in high school.
And so I spent the first A and B sections of the book doing classical Latin pronunciations, and then I went back and started understanding better what Carl Linnaeus was doing, and that's really what the pronunciation is a combination, in a way, of some of the ecclesiastical Latin, some of the classical, and then just some of what the scientists sort of decided on. I went back and redid my A's and B's because it was clear that I had not done that correctly. So it was, and then, of course, the other thing that happens with this is that a number of birds have been named after people. And then what we did there was try to make the name as true to its native pronunciation as possible.
Like Linnaeus himself.
Yes.
You often see his name Latinized.
Exactly. Yes. Carolus.
Carolus Linnaeus.
Carolus Linnaeus,
right.
Yes.
From Carl von Linné.
Right. Yeah. So
my guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr, And they have a new book, Latin for Bird Lovers. And we're talking about the Latin aspect, but there's so much more in this book than just a list of these names that birds get two names. And what other information did you decide to include in this book, Roger?
Well, we have some biographies of birdwatchers or famous ornithologists, and we put a couple in there who I thought were really interesting. James Bond, a lot of people.
I thought those.
Yeah, yes. A lot of people don't know that James Bond was actually an ornithologist, a well-known one. And Ian Fleming, who met him in Jamaica, eventually met him in Jamaica, actually named a character 007 after James Bond without asking James Bond. And then they finally met. And in fact, it was filmed by BBC. And then the other one is Phoebe Snetsinger, who I thought was a terrific woman. Phoebe Snetsinger spent some 20 years after she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. She spent another 20 years, took up bird watching, and saw more birds than anybody else in the world up until that point. And she was killed in a car accident in Madagascar, but she got to be really well known because of what she did.
Mm-hmm. You know what else I found, besides the fact that James Bond was a real person, he was an ornithologist, but I imagined this figure being born in England. He was born in Philadelphia.
Right.
And ended up dying in Philadelphia. But this real person, James Bond, was actually born in the United States.
Right.
His father was British, you say, in your book.
The other thing I think that's really interesting about the book is that when we were talking about putting the book together, there was a book called Latin for Gardeners. And it gave the term and it gave the plant, but it didn't make the connection between the scientific name and the name by which we tend to know the plant. And I thought what Roger had added to the mix was trying at least in a fairly contracted way to explain why a bird might be called something, sort of why. Maybe you can give a good example.
Well, there's a lot of names that are pretty standard. They're named after colors, they're named after people, they're named after shapes, and, spotted or striped, fasciata is striped, those kinds of things. But I had a hard time finding a few things, and one of them was imperfecta. One was named something imperfecta, was a species name, and I'm trying to figure out why would they name this imperfecta? And it took me hours, but I finally found a paper written in the 1800s that described the specimen. All these names are based on one specimen that was collected somewhere, which is why, like the great horned owl, Boo Boo virginianus, because it was first described in Virginia. And so this bird named imperfecta, why would they name it imperfecta? Well, it turns out at that time they used to shoot birds. And this one was so badly shot up, it was missing half its feathers and was an imperfect specimen, so they named it imperfecta, which, of course, really has nothing to do with the living bird.
The bird itself, yeah. My guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. Their book is Latin for Bird Lovers. They're both retired professors from California State University, and it makes for a very interesting collaboration because I was always interested in biology and languages and thought, well, now how could those possible be there an overlap there? But there is in your case. So in your book, you give the list of the scientific names. People can look that up. You give profiles of people who have contributed to our knowledge of birds, and you have topics about birds that I found so fascinating. And for example, feathers. I mean, we know what feathers are, but when I read your section on feathers, I thought, I had no idea.
Mm.
So what did you include in your section on feathers that might surprise people like me?
Well, I just got done reading another book, actually, on feathers, which had a lot more detail than this does.
But information is very concise, and I like that.
But very concise. Well, the feathers are amazing. I mean, they produce insulation. They produce lift. They produce not only insulation for the bird, but insulation for the babies. They produce either fast flight or slow flight. There's all kinds of different feathers. The pin feathers are tactile, so the bird knows where his other feathers are. Those kinds of things. They're amazing inventions.
Well, for example, I don't know if listeners noticed the order in which you said that. You didn't say birds are for, that feathers are for flight, which most of us assume, well, that's why feathers evolve for flight. But you said you named insulation first.
That's apparently why they evolved, insulation, although there's some discussion about that. Maybe the first reason they came about was just insulation. We know dinosaurs, birds are modern dinosaurs. We know dinosaurs, some of them were warm-blooded, and they had to you know, insulate themselves somehow so they didn't lose their body heat, and feathers are one way of doing it. Some of the new information also says that it used to be that feathers evolved from scales of reptiles. They didn't. They were separate evolutionary process to produce feathers. There was some argument about that, but over the last 12 years or so, they've decided that's probably what it is.
So feathers for insulation, feathers for flight, and then there's a third use of feathers, or fourth.
For decoration. Obviously, they've become, you look at the birds of paradise, they're absolutely amazing animals who have this sexual selection. They have all these displays with their fancy feathers as well as sounds that attract females.
So they're feathers for courtship, but also for camouflage. Some of these little tiny birds are pretty vulnerable.
You know, cryptocoloring is very important. The other thing I thought was fascinating about the owls is they have sort of fraying on the feather so they can fly silently. And for a predator, that's not a bad strategy.
Sneak up on your prey if your feathers are quiet.
Yeah, except in the case of Pell's fishing owl that feeds on fish, they don't fly silently, but you don't have to when they feed on fish.
If they're underwater, yeah. Well, there are these specialized feathers that you mentioned, and I thought it was interesting that from what you described, I imagine that for the reason that cats have whiskers, like little feelers out there, that birds actually have bristles.
Right. That was actually my first research project in graduate school. I filmed these birds at 400 frames per second and watched how they use their bristles. They don't use them to catch flies. What we think they're used for is to indicate how fast a bird is going. So he turns left, turns right. He knows, just like when you close your eyes, you know which way you're going and you know where your arms are. Well, the bristles do the same thing. They tell the bird how fast he or she is going and, you know, in what direction and down, up, and those kinds of things.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, we'll hear more from co-authors Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. My guests are Carol Burr and Roger Lederer, and they have collaborated on the book Latin for Bird Lovers. Roger is an ornithologist, and Carol's specialty is language, literature, and so they've collaborated on this book that includes lots of words. And Carol, you probably were in charge maybe of the listing of the nomenclature, the two, and of course binomial means two names.
Yes.
Why don't you explain how that came about, or what you, the work you did for the binomial that is redundant, actually, binomial nomenclature, but forgive me.
That's definitely really Roger's initiative, but we wanted to include the genus and the species, it's a way of understanding the relationship between birds. And of course our understanding of what constitutes a species is that the birds can interbreed and produce healthy offspring, and I think that's probably still the main taxonomical reason for determining, and apparently there's a lot of change. One of the things we sort of did a caveat in the introduction is that because of DNA and other things, it's changing.
It's
a moving target, very much so, and it's getting more and more sophisticated with the DNA analysis. But I think that was why there the other side pieces, in addition to the names, is a discussion of the different genera, the different, to some extent family as well. But we focused on the genus and the species, like Homo and sapiens. And Homo is, of course, the larger category. category, but then sapiens is the one that we, as opposed to erectus or some of the other species categories.
You also, here's the English teacher, and you give a warning to the reader about the word species is both singular and plural.
Well, the species is not, has nothing to do with species.
That is a word, yes.
It is a word. Yeah, it is a word.
It's a gold coin.
It's a gold coin, yes. It will not help you with ornithology. But, you know, and that's also true, that genuses is not with its genera. And so I guess we sort of were, you know, trying to kind of make that accurate so that, mm-hmm. because I think what's appealing about this to some extent is that when you are a bird watcher and common names, even though Roger has explained that there are official common names for birds that are understood internationally, but frequently birds will have more than one sort of regional name that's been given to the bird, and so this is really a way of understanding birds globally, and I think it's one of the few animals that has this clarity in terms of naming. So it's appropriate.
Right, exactly. The whole purpose of scientific name, well, it's two purposes. One is to put the birds in a relationship with every other organism. Every living organism has a scientific name. And they all have a classification, started with kingdom, down, you know, and we go through fish or birds or whatever it happens to be. And so every scientific name denotes exactly where these organisms lie in the whole scheme of biology. And it gives international workers a way to communicate with one another. I've been to international congresses, you know, with people speaking different languages, and if we had a different name for every bird, we wouldn't know what we're talking about. So they have specific common names. But as Carol said, I mean, specific scientific names, but as Carol said, there are common names. The International Ornithological Congress has decided on common names for all 10,000 birds, common English names. Now, they may call them something else in Africa or Asia, but in English-speaking countries, there are official common names. It makes it a lot handier for us, especially when we go on bird walks and we say, that's a scrub jay and not a F.L. Coma cirrolescens, which people couldn't write down nearly as fast.
It's very interesting. And, of course, some of the bird names, some of the scientific names are based on the call, the bird call. And so Roger has the one that's become the most popular when we're explaining this.
You know, people ask about that. What's your favorite name or favorite bird? And I don't really have one, but the one that's most interesting to me is there's a bird called a hoopoe, which you may have seen because you were in France lately. They are mm-hmm. in France. He's like a little orange kind of woodpecker that pokes on the ground. Really interesting bird. It's one of a kind. It's its own species and genus and family and order. And it's Eupupa epops is a scientific name. It's named after the sound as well as the name hoopoe. But it also has its own family, Eupupidae, and its own order, Eupupiformes. So when I give this talk sometime, I'll say this bird is in Eupupiformes, Eupupidae, Eupupa epops, the hoopoe.
He's the only one I know who can say that.
Well, that sounds like the sound that the bird makes. So
yes.
That's the source of some names, the sound that the bird makes himself. I'm always interested in that in other languages when the name of the bird, the commonly used, is the sound that the bird makes, an imitation of that. You mentioned that some of them are named for the person, not really the person that maybe gave the name,
right.
But named for some person.
It is an honorary thing. I mean, mm-hmm.
So you don't name it for yourself.
You don't name it for yourself.
That's sort of unwritten rule. You don't do that.
Right. And it's generally meant as a kind of a tribute to that mm-hmm. person. I know when Audubon named the Bewick's wren, it was named after Thomas Bewick, or Bewick, depending on which Englishman you talk to. He was an ornithologist in England, and so you know, when you come to the names, it's sort of interesting because you'd learn a little bit about the person for whom the bird was mm-hmm. named. So
they're named for people, for
yes.
the sound they make.
Yes, for their behavior.
For their behavior.
Right, for their habitat in some cases, for their coloration, for their, for example, whether they have a crest on the top of the head or whether they have bands on the wings, the shape of the tail. And so there are some words that you'll find repeating themselves because they're rhynchus for nose and mm-hmm. Ura for tail and... I'm trying to think, cephala for head, and you'll find that a number of the names, then you start going, oh, there's another cephala, another thing where it's something about the shape of the head or the color of the head. And one example that Roger has explained, and I think it's fascinating, is the bald eagle, which actually is not bald. Obviously, it has white feathers, and that's because the bald is actually coming from piebald. I thought that was an interesting kind of explanation of something. You're going, why is it a bald eagle? Well, no, it's a piebald eagle. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a lot of fun when you start noticing all the different reasons for the bird name. And most of them are descriptive. Some of them are based on mythology, which can throw you completely for a loop. And then the origin of the language is really Indo-European, but it came through the Greek and then the Latin. And so you have some names that are really looking quite Greek in origin, mm-hmm. others that are clearly Latin, and then some that you're going, okay, well, they obviously wanted to make it like the sound of the bird, and it's not coming from anywhere familiar. And then the mythology is very complicated.
Well, can you give us an example of one name for behavior of the bird?
Okay. Now, I did. I wrote something down on that. Let's see if I can do this here. Okay. The red-winged blackbird, Agelaus phoeniceus, is named for its behavior because it's a gregarious bird, and that's where the Agelaus comes from. And then also in the phoeniceus, that's a wing coloration, which is deep red. So sometimes you'll get a combination of behavior and color. Or, and habitat. Let me see. What do we find? What did I find for habitat?
I can think, well, common names, Savannah Sparrow, Savannah. And Marsh Wren, and those kinds of things,
right.
Reed Warbler.
Now, you mentioned color.
Yes.
And something that I found fascinating was that this bird we call the red-breasted robin, and you think, well, but that's not red. And I grew up, my hair isn't very red now, but I grew up, people call their hair red, but it really wasn't red, it was orange.
Right.
And I found out from reading your book about the color orange.
Right.
And what happened with that?
They didn't have a word for orange at the time. It was all sort of one color, red. I mean, like now, when you go to paint samples, you know, 10,000 different names for blue or red. Well, they only had simple names for those things, and they only had a few dyes here and there, so they just didn't have one for orange.
Right.
Well, my husband always thought that men in particular were limited in their range of colors. They knew about three basic colors. And so I thought about that when you said that you said the color orange wasn't even known as a color until the 16th century.
16th century, right.
That was amazing to me. So this red-breasted robin, of course, is actually orange. So the terminology, the names that are applied, sometimes puzzle us, like you were talking about the bald eagle. What were some other surprises as you researched these names?
Well, I mean, there's some like the red-bellied woodpecker doesn't have a red belly, but it has a little tiny pink wash. And that came from the fact that whoever named it had it in his hand, a dead specimen, saw the pink very close up and said, oh, we've got a red-bellied woodpecker. But you're seeing in the field, you can't find that red belly. So there are a number of things like that that come from artifacts. And some of these things they've cleaned up, and some they just, you know, it's just sort of interesting. So they'll keep it, everybody understands.
My guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. Roger is an ornithologist, and Carol's specialty was English language. So you collaborated on this, and you mentioned, Roger, you're often asked about your favorite bird, and you like the name, saying the name. I have a favorite bird, too, and that's the crow. And so I was very interested in what you had to say about the crow. What do people find interesting about crows?
They're very smart. Some of them are particularly smart. It depends on which crow you're talking about. There are bunches of them, but they're all, the whole crow family is probably the most intelligent of birds. There have been studies on New Caledonian crow, which is a special species just found in New Caledonia. They can actually make tools. Now, some birds use tools, but they actually make tools, break little branches, make little hooks out of them so they can get the fruit and things like that. Lots of experiments done on crows. Corvus brachyrhynchos, the crow with a wide bill.
Well, speaking of bills, because you have a section in your book, one of these topics is on beaks, and you say that the beaks are a reflection of a bird's lifestyle. And there's a photograph. By the way, your book visually is so reader-friendly. I really enjoyed, and maybe your editor did all that, but it was very easy to read. You'd have boxes, Latin in action over on the side, beautiful colored pictures of the birds.
Yeah, they did a nice job.
They
hanging
did
out.
A beautiful job visually. So I get this picture of the rhinoceros hornbill, and that is really a bizarre beak.
Right.
Describe to people what that beak looks like.
Well, it's a big, heavy beak, that down-curved beak, but on top of it is another horn, rhinoceros kind of horn that sticks up. And what most hornbills do is they, the male walls the female in a hole in a tree and then walls it in with mud so the female can only stick her beak out and he can only stick his beak in, and she raises the eggs and young in there. It's a way of protection. And if a predator comes along, they stick their beak out, big, heavy beak, both for feeding and for protection.
Yeah, so here's this bird that has one beak. I mean, most beaks are rather elegant looking. They're, I think, visually pleasing. And here's this bird with this rhinoceros horn on top of his beak. And that really is bizarre looking.
Yeah, the shoebill that we saw in Uganda was an incredible looking beak. So maybe you can explain a little bit about that.
Well, it's a big, odd bird. It's about five, 6 feet tall, fairly rare. And it's got a beak as big as a size 12 shoe. And it looks like a shoe.
Yeah.
That's hard to imagine.
Pretty amazing. But what I said about birds' beaks reflect their lifestyle, because that's their tool. If you had only one tool, like you had a pair of pliers or you had a hammer, and that's all you had, that's all you can make your living with, there's only certain things you can do. And so birds with really long bills live very different life than birds with really short bills and so on.
Well, and that whole thing with the Galapagos finches, because each island had a different food source to some extent. So the beaks reflected, the food source and what the birds needed to survive on that particular island. I mean, that was something that Darwin really did quite a bit of work on. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. It is. This whole thing that you can look at the bird's beak and tell what his lifestyle is. What always amazes me, too, when I find a bird's nest, say, on the ground or a tree, and I look at that and imagine I could not possibly, with my 10 fingers and tools at my disposal, create what this bird has created with his beak and a talon. I find that incredible.
Typically, just with the beak, they may bring, certain birds can bring things in, but most of them will just use their beak, and some of them will take weeks. The weaver birds of Africa will take 3 or 4 weeks to build a big, long, hanging nest up in a tree somewhere so predators can't get to them. So, and some of them, the oven birds of South America, will build these birds that look like bake ovens that the natives used to use, made out of mud.
But I'm always astounded that with just that beak, they can build that. Yep. And I also was interested in the fact that the beak has some parts that are sensitive and some parts, obviously, like our fingernails and hair, we can cut our fingernails and hair and we don't feel any pain. But skin is in that same thing. We feel that in the skin. So how does a bird's beak help them in as far as sensitivity?
Well, the birds that are probing in the ground are probing like in sand, like a whimbrel or a willet, something like that. They'll stick their bill into the sand, and they can find prey that way. And they can actually don't have to touch it. They don't have to feel it. They don't have to see it. They can sense it with pressure-sensitive corpuscles in their bills. And then they can find out where this thing is.
Yeah, that is amazing to me. My guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. And they have collaborated on a book, Latin for Bird Lovers. And that's the title here in the United States, and I think in England, Latin for Bird Lovers. But I understand in Australia, they've given it a different title.
Latin for Bird Watchers.
Bird Watchers.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. I sort of argued for the Latin for Bird Watchers in the first place, but the people who know about marketing and things like that and the publishing, they said they decided Bird Lovers. I said, well, okay.
Well, when I was back before now, I considered people who were interested in birds, bird watchers, and they call themselves, I hear around Chico, birders.
Yeah, there's a fine line of difference. Bird watchers are generally considered people sitting in their kitchen and looking out at the birds at their feet or walking down the block and seeing a couple of finches in the gutter somewhere. And while birders are out, they go out to go watch birds. That's their whole purpose in life, or when they go out and look for things.
But they're the big ear people. Did you see the film with Steve Martin? It was about these guys competing to who could see the most North American birds in a year. And one went bankrupt in the process. I mean, these are people who are diehard. The birders.
I know some people who travel all over the world doing that.
Solely for that.
So there is a distinction then between bird watchers and birders.
Yeah,
and
but it's a pretty loose distinction. In England, they call them twitchers, the avid bird watchers.
Thank you for taking us on this fascinating adventure with birds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guests have been Roger Lederer and Carol Burr, and their new book is Latin for Bird Lovers. My two guests today have enjoyed the flumes and trails of Paradise, California since 1986 when they moved there from Maine. Since Roger Eakins retired from Butte College, where he was a professor of English and chair of the honors program, he and his wife, Helen Eakins, have hiked or biked together almost daily. Roger Eakins has published poetry, short fiction, and essays, and his book, Defending Zion, is winner of the Mormon History Association's Best Documentary History Award. In 2013, the Eakins published a comprehensive, history-based trail guide for the Paradise Ridge, The Flumes and Trails of Paradise, which was the bestseller at a Chico bookstore that year, and it was the second best-selling book in 2014. Roger and Helen Eakins have now revised and expanded their trail guide, The Flumes and Trails of Paradise, Hiking Through History on the Ridge. Welcome, Roger and Helen Eakins.
Good to be with you again, Nancy.
Thank you.
Well, it was a lot of research that went into this book because you were checking when you'd find something that would pique your curiosity about the history of the area. You would delve into that. You got photographs. And I would think most people say, oh, whew, okay, that was a lot of work. We're done. That's it. But when I interviewed you after your previous edition came out, you were already thinking about the next edition. Why was that?
Well, we kept finding new trails, and we kept finding new flowers we hadn't identified before, and, you know, it just seemed like if we were ever going to do it again, we should just really go for it and add a number of trails, and by the time we got around to doing it, we had about 15 totally new trails, plus we had extensive new information on 15 of the old trails, because we kept finding new things and little side trails and that sort of thing.
In fact, I was surprised when I picked up your book, this edition, and compared it to the last one, it was nearly twice as large, twice as thick as the first
one. About 40% larger, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember, too, when the first one came out, it was probably the second edition, what I'm calling the first, which was the bestseller. And I was surprised that this earlier edition, you were inviting, well, not surprised, but you were inviting readers to let you know if they wanted more maps, for example, because you only included a couple of maps.
Right.
And you said, readers, do you want more maps? Or did you find inaccuracies? Because sometimes I would guess that when you're looking up history, not all your sources would agree.
Oh, sure. There were a number of little things that we found were wrong. In fact, the location of the Bracket Flume, we had erroneously indicated it was Coal Canyon. The old map said Owen Canyon, but there's no map today that says Owen Canyon, so we had a hard time finding it. But we finally actually found the actual brackets in the wall of the right canyon. So little things like that. We just kept discovering new things and adding stuff in.
So what kinds of things did readers tell you? Say, yeah, we want more maps, or we'd like more information about this or that. What did readers tell you?
Well, actually, some of our readers told us where things we'd look for in the past were, and one of them was called the aptly named Hidden Fall. We could not find the Hidden Fall for anything. What we did find was a lot of poison oak and a very steep hill and no waterfall. And one of our readers said, I know where Hidden Fall is. And it's one of those few places that has suffered considerably from the lack of water this year. So that's in our new
Your new edition.
Our new edition, and it is delightful. It's a beautiful place, pristine. You can even go swimming.
So that must have been fun for you to get the feedback, because obviously there was a need for this guide because it was such a good seller here locally, because it didn't exist. You created something that didn't exist, and there was a need for.
Well, we kept saying someone ought to write a book.
And you decided that's us.
I guess
that'd
be us.
We should write that
book.
That's right. Because you not only had the experience of walking the trails, so there's your interest in the outdoors and nature, but you also, your academic background, Roger, for example, I noticed you didn't want inaccuracies in your book if you could avoid that.
if at all possible. And, you know, you keep finding little things. We do have a website where we include any updates, any errata, anything that's changed, a sign that's taken down or added, that sort of thing. So our readers can go to our website to find out the latest information on a particular trail. But, yeah, we are able to get a lot of things even more right this time around.
Well, I noticed also in the middle of your book, there are a lot of color photographs of flowers. And you also give, I guess the word is credit, to the authors of a book on the wildflowers of Table Mountain.
Well, I think Albin Bills and Samantha's, their book, Samantha Hilaire, their book probably inspired our book. I would say, you know, we saw that, and we looked at that, and we thought, you know, we ought to do one like that.
Yeah, because their book sold well also because people are interested in the local flowers, and you see how much interest there is in the walking the flumes and trails at Paradise.
Yeah, we made a point of not taking photographs for the most part of the flowers on Table Mountain. That's already been done.
Right.
So anyone that's interested in the flora of Table Mountain, that book is absolutely indispensable.
Well, so you give them credit for inspiring your idea.
You bet.
You also give credit to Jim Brochiers, and I happen to have interviewed him at some point a few years ago, and you refer to him as one of our town's greatest assets. And what was the role that Jim played?
Well, it's interesting. I went into his shop, and I had heard from someone else that he was starting to write up some trail guides. And I thought, oh, no, we're doing this, and he's doing this. I better make sure we're not working at cross purposes. So I went in and we sat down and we talked, and he showed me what he was doing. I showed him what I was doing, and he said, what you're doing is a lot more extensive than what I was planning on doing. And he was wonderful to look over our early manuscript and give suggestions. He steered us onto a couple of trails we didn't know about, so he was very helpful to us. And, of course, while his shop was still going, he was one of our best vendors.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. We're going to take a break, and then I'll be back with my guests, Roger and Helen Eakins. My guests are Helen and Roger Eakins, and they have revised and expanded their trail guide, The Flumes and Trails of Paradise. And when we talk about flumes, maybe we should not assume that everybody listening knows what a flume is. What is a flume?
Well, the flumes are man-made canals, but the actual flume part is the elevated, and they're usually freestanding, and some of them can be pretty exciting, especially the ones that are just behind the Feather River Hospital. In fact, on the page on the back of our book shows one of those flumes, one of the longer ones on the Miocene.
Well, you use the word exciting. I might even border on the word scary.
Well, PG&E has put up signs discouraging people from going on those elevated walkways. They don't want to be liable for anybody getting hurt, and certainly we would encourage anyone to be very careful. We discourage people from getting in inner tubes and floating down the canals as PG&E does, and we always encourage people to be very careful with their equipment and not mess with any of their stuff.
And with their dogs, because I could see how if I find that kind of scary, I would think dogs would sometimes balk at being asked to walk
across
the flume.
Some dogs will not go on that catwalk. Maybe that's
smart dogs.
For anything. Others have no problem with it. You just don't know until you take your dog there and try it.
Well, can you take your dog anywhere?
Well, there are some places, some of the trails are, there are some places where dogs are not allowed, like around Paradise Lake. And there are some places where dogs are supposed to be kept on leash. And we indicate all of that in the book, so people, dog lovers will know where they can take their pets and where they can't.
because my husband and I used to, like, when we would walk the flumes and trails, we wanted to take our dogs because they love that. Mm. Well, and they're also family-friendly places and maybe places it might not be the best idea to take little ones.
Well, there's several places that we suggest. One of our favorites, of course, is the Paradise property that's a park.
The PPOA?
Yeah. Oh, the PPOA.
But, oh, you're talking about Paradise Billy Park.
Yeah, Billy Park, yeah. Which is just a delight. They have all kinds of play equipment there, but they also have some simple guided hikes and beautiful views, and it's a kind of a safe place to take little ones. And if they're restless, you know, you haven't ruined your day.
You've still got that playground waiting for you.
Yeah, you still have the playground.
Well, since you mentioned the beautiful views, is there a particular time of year that's better than others to walk these trails?
This is an ideal time right now in the fall. It's probably one of the best times. Our favorite probably, though, would be in the spring because hopefully there'll be more waterfalls in the spring to enjoy. And there are a lot of waterfalls that we've identified in the book. And in fact, we have one page we call it Special Interest Hikes. So you can look it up, and if you're interested in a hike with waterfalls, we'll list all the hikes that have waterfalls. Or if you're interested in really great vistas, we have one that shows the vistas, or ones that are particularly good for cyclists, and we indicate what those are.
Well, I would think just about any time of year there are special treats. For example, when the leaves aren't wintertime, you can see farther because the leaves don't obscure your view.
A good example of that is the Phantom on the very cover. You see that guy right there, the Phantom of Phantom. We call it Phantom Falls, the Phantom at Clear Creek Falls. And you can't see him or her. I don't know the gender. You can't see the Phantom during the time when the leaves are out because the leaves obscure that Phantom. But during the winter and late fall, then there he is.
Well, maybe you should describe for listeners what your cover looks like and what this is you're talking about when you say Phantom.
Well, it shows a picture of some beautiful waterfalls on Clear Creek, which is off the Butte Creek Trail. And there's a kind of a green giant that looks like he's about to take a drink out of the waterfall. If you use your imagination, you can see his goat. He's got a goatee and a mouth and a nose and eyes. See it all right?
I do.
Okay. Yeah, that's our Phantom.
My guests are Helen and Roger Eakins, and they have revised and expanded their best-selling book, The Flumes and Trails of Paradise, Hiking Through History on the Ridge. So when you were hiking, I know because when my husband and I would walk, we would think, gosh, I wonder what the history of that, whatever it is that we saw. It looked like it would be very intriguing, wondered how old it was, for example. So that must have sent you to the library to research, what is the history of this, whatever it is you would encounter.
Well, some of our readers brought to our attention a bunch of huge pieces of what was left over from an ore-preparing mill that's just on the Miocene on the other side of Highway 70. He had come across some structures, which he shared with us, and just before it was ready to go to press, I was desperately rushing through the Paradise Library information to try the information. And lo and behold, they built an ore processing mill in order to get the gold that was still left from the hard pan and the leftovers in the transportation tunnel called the Eureka Tunnel that was left over from the Cherokee Spring Mine. And they're kind of fun. One of our readers actually led us to the fact that it was an ore-producing mill because they said that they used to play paintball games out there. They said, oh, I know what that is.
Well, you mentioned gold. Do people go thinking maybe they might find some gold?
The book sells really well up at Bill Anderson's coin shop. There's a lot of gold seekers that I'm sure that have utilized the book to try to find their way to various water courses and so forth. I think most of those guys know how to get to where they need to go anyway already.
Well, there are interesting things, too, that would bear on history, and that, for example, the cemetery. Centerville has a cemetery. There's even a grave to a Christian dog. I know there's a movie that all dogs go to heaven, but Dusty was a Christian dog.
Well, we make that assumption because Dusty's grave is marked with a cross. And for years, we'd go, this is down on one of the POA trails on the trail to Little Falls. and we'd go past Dusty's grave. Of course, we're assuming Dusty's a dog. Could be a cat, I suppose. I guess people make graves for cats as well as dogs. But Dusty sounds like a dog to me.
I think so.
And for years, we'd see that cross. And then one time we went down, the cross wasn't there. And it wasn't there for a long time. And then we found it in the stream. And so we retrieved it and took it back up and panted it back into the ground. So Dusty's cross is back with him.
Well, I can imagine maybe Dusty liked hiking the trail. And this owner thinks Dusty would really like to lie in repose there on the trail. But now, this is an animal that you would be happy to see, but you also caution in your book animals that maybe you might not be so happy to see. What about bears? I mean, I'd love to see a bear. I don't know how close I would like to be.
A lot of the bears are starting to come down. In fact, more wildlife than we'd like because, we don't know if it's because of. It's guessed that maybe they're coming down because their resources are lacking up where they are because of the water. I know they've had a lot of more bear sightings up in Sterling City. Usually the bears are more afraid of us.
My guests are Roger and Helen Eakins, and their book is The Flumes and Trails of Paradise, Hiking Through History on the Ridge. And they have revised and expanded the edition, the 2013 edition, here in 2015. When people are walking, you don't tell them how far it is from one point to the next, do you? In miles, that is, do you?
Sometimes we measure it in miles because we've used our odometer on our bicycle to measure it. Other times we do it in terms of minutes based on a 20-minute to a mile pace. So it kind of depends on whether we are riding or walking when we paced off that particular trail.
Because my walking pace has changed. I was younger, I walked a lot faster than I do.
So was ours, to tell the truth. So you have to adjust. You have to adjust accordingly.
But that's helpful, though, to know that that's what you consider a pace is a 20-minute per mile. And what kinds of sources did you use when you were looking up history? For example, did you have journals or did you just go to the library? How did you find out? Because not all history is written down in formal books.
Well, now, the Butte Historical Society, that's where I got the information about that mill. They have some excellent source information. And, of course,
the Gold Nugget Museum has a wonderful reading room. There is a bibliography right at the back of our book. So we didn't want to make this real scholarly, so we didn't use footnotes or anything, but there is a complete bibliography of all our sources. And so one can look at that, and it goes on for one, two, three, four pages of sources. So we did a lot of research up for this, especially for the first chapter, which is kind of a history of the flumes. It talks about how they were developed for mining purposes, then how they evolved into agricultural and now domestic water purposes.
Well, another, speaking of what's in your book, a couple of places you mentioned, because you retired, Roger, from Butte College, and the college benefits from the sales of this book. Tell us how that works.
Well, we donate all the proceeds. Most of it's gone to the Butte College Foundation. We've also donated to a few other local groups, such as the Paradise Performing Arts Center. We helped provide the funding for a new bridge on one of the PPOA trails. So we've just donated all
scholarships.
For the Butte College, that's what it goes for, is for scholarships.
Well, you I mentioned things that, like, animals that you might want to avoid, and Helen, you mentioned poison oak. So how do, if you encounter poison oak, you might not know you encountered it if you're walking with your dog. No?
Well, that's true enough. Usually, I don't know that we mentioned this in the book. I'd have to peruse it now, but we usually recommend people go home, shower right away, take all the clothes, put them in the laundry, and, put them in the washing machine, and use dishwashing soap to bathe yourself in the shower, because that helps to cut the oil from the plant.
One thing people should remember, though, is the poison oak is always present. So even this time of year, after the leaves have gone, if you see a bunch of brown twigs sticking straight up, that's probably poison oak, and you want to avoid them.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah, you can get it any time of year.
So be wary of poison oak, animals that you might encounter. What about motorized vehicles? Are they in...
I don't think they're allowed on any of these trails. I don't think any of the trails we've got here, motorized vehicles are allowed on. The only exception would be if PG&E has left a gate open to one of their roads. They go through a kind of a rotating system where sometimes they'll leave some roads open, other times they'll close them off. So that would be the only exception.
You also mentioned, when I asked if you wore a bell, because you said the two of you always hike together, and you recommend that, not hiking by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a problem.
Well, there's lots of reasons not to hike by yourself. You could break your leg. All kinds of things can happen. If you're off by yourself, then, you know, it's kind of hard to get help.
But then on the other hand, if you are walking by yourself, please leave a note. Tell them when you left, where you're going, and your expectation about when you'll be back. Because for years when Roger was not retired, I was walking these trails by myself. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I would borrow a dog for company. But most of the time, I felt secure and safe enough if I was going at a good time. Also, some of these trails, like the trail, the DeSable Powerhouse Trail, the folks of PG&E, and also there's another generating station down there, they're usually down on that road once a day. So at least you know that somebody will find your body before it turns to carrion.
One of the really neat things about these trails is that although it feels like you're away from civilization by a good long shot, you're not really that far away from civilization.
But it's nice to have that feeling that you're out in nature.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you mentioned that there are maps. The reason you didn't include a lot of maps, there are several reasons. And why didn't you include a lot of maps?
We're too lazy. We didn't mention that one. Now, it would have increased the cost of the book significantly. We figured we'd rather have more pictures of wildflowers and that sort of thing. And actually, people have found that they really don't need, other than the trailhead map, which we provide, they really don't need maps because we give people basically a minute-by-minute description of how to get there. We also give GPS settings so that somebody wants to use their GPS to get to the trailhead, or if there's a particularly difficult place to find, we give that GPS setting as well. So maps really aren't that necessary.
So one thing is they may not need maps. They need your book. And then, Helen, there's a photograph of the two of you, and you have walking poles.
Oh, those are an absolute must for me. I have some health challenges. And those two hiking poles are incredible aids for me. Even if you don't have health challenges, having those two poles makes a big difference as far as going up and down hills. It'll save your knees going down, and going up, you're much stronger, and it's like having four legs instead of two. And you'll get a pretty good upper body workout.
So if people say, oh, but I can't walk for very far, or you... you've got all levels of walk. You don't have to walk as far, or you can choose a less challenging one. So if somebody's saying, oh, I don't know if I could do that, there is a way.
Absolutely. We've got you up to 40 miles round trip, or maybe a mile. So whatever you're ready for, we've got it.
Well, it really is a helpful guide, and I know people are eager to get the revised and expanded edition of The Flumes and Trails of Paradise, Hiking Through History on the Ridge. Thank you, Roger and Helen Eakins. Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
Thank you. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.